It's 6 after 9 on this Friday, February 22nd, 2008. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Kathleen will be back next Tuesday. Well, it's been a long presidential race, and we're not even to the conventions yet. Senators Clinton and Obama debated again last night for what I think was the 19th time. Meanwhile, we have John McCain claiming victory in the Republican nomination race, but Mike Huckabee and Ron Paul refuse to go away. All this means that we won't have any shortage of things to talk about this morning as we spend the hour with Matt Bai, whose political column, The Primary Argument, appears in the New York Times Magazine. If you want to get in on the discussion, start calling now. Here are the numbers. 800-486-8655, toll free. 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, please use 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Matt Bai joins us by telephone. Good morning. Welcome to the program. Okay, I can't hear Matt. Somebody needs to do something. Well, let me start with Republicans. It doesn't seem all that long ago that Rudy Giuliani was considered the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party. What happened to that? Okay, Matt, I think I can hear you now.
You got me?
Yeah, I got you now.
Hey, how are you?
Well, I'm better now.
Hey, let me make one small correction for your audience, just so in case they're looking. The primary argument is actually the online column at NewYorkTimes.com. I write for the New York Times Magazine generally.
Oh, okay.
If they're looking
that
for
was
that,
my...
they need to go online.
Online. Okay, that was my bad.
Well, it gets confusing. There's a lot of forums flying around these days.
I'm easily confused. That probably should appear on my tombstone.
You and me.
Okay.
Both.
Well, I started trying to write a list of questions for this show, and I think I gave up. I gave up about 5 minutes into that effort because I had nowhere. There's just too much stuff here for an hour program. Well, let's try and deal with it anyway. It doesn't seem that long ago that Rudy Giuliani was considered the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party and Hillary Clinton was the presumptive nominee of the Democrats. I mean, it was, okay, well, this is over. And that was
right
before anybody had cast a vote or even gone into a caucusing place. Everything that's happened since then seems to me there's been no conventional wisdom. It hasn't been conventional and certainly hasn't been wise.
Right. Well, that's because they were the presumptive nominees among a bunch of journalists and people on TV. And I'm not being hypocritical about this because I said this all through last year and into the fall that, you know, voters make their own decisions. And until people get out in front of voters and talk to them and try to make their case, we really don't know how it's going to play. You can't judge it by money. You can't judge it by national polls and name recognition before you get into the heart of a campaign. So a lot of those presumptions were bound to fail. You know, in Giuliani's case, that was a little bit easier to see. I mean, he was never really a presumptive nominee. He had a lot of name recognition and good feeling, but that field was always a little more difficult to predict. You know, I think in Senator Clinton's case, there was an overwhelming belief, certainly in Washington, that she was going to run essentially as an incumbent candidate, that she was going to have a tremendous amount of institutional support. But there were many of us who cautioned that that her relationship to Democratic voters was more complicated than people thought it was. And I think she was a strong candidate, and she's still a strong candidate, and still has a chance to win. But I do think the obstacles facing her have always been more formidable than a lot of people sort of breezily discussing it painted them to be.
Well, the discussion about Senator Clinton was always more about her negatives rather than her positives or the things that she could do, but the things that she was likely to encounter as obstacles. And that seemed to just dog her footsteps everywhere she went. People talked about, well, you know, she's popular among Democrats, but she has a lot of negatives, and that seemed to be what the main discussion was about, rather than, well, where is she on the issues?
Well, but I think even her popularity among Democrats is an issue, and I say this because there's all this focus now, of course, that she's in a difficult situation. There's all this talk about tactics and money, and if they'd spent here, if they'd organized this way, if they'd you know, it's a, you always run a bad campaign when you're losing and a great campaign when you're winning. But the truth of the matter, I think, is that she has significant limits inside her own party. As I've written a whole cover on this in December, there's a tremendous amount of ambivalence among Democratic voters for the Clinton years and the Clinton legacy, and that's substantive stuff like free trade and welfare reform, but it also revolves around sort of a fatigue with scandals and the rumors and the secrecy and the culture of it. And I think when you really sit down and look at it, when you spend a lot of time in the universe of Democratic voters, as I have over the last couple of years, I wrote a book about it. You find that she has a real trouble with the liberal activist base of the party. She has trouble with conservative Democrats. And, you know, then somewhere along the line here, she, you know, suffered the almost complete defection of the African-American vote, which had been very loyal to the Clintons. That creates a very difficult mathematical situation for a candidate, and it's very difficult to overcome.
Well, I'd like to look at the Republicans first, because there's been probably hours of discussion of last night's debate, and which leads to discussion of where the Democrats are and the whole convention thing. And we're not going to skip that. I want to come back to it. I want to talk about the Republicans first.
Sure.
McCain is a prohibitive front runner, but Mike Huckabee and Ron Paul refuse to go away. Why is that?
I don't know. At the end of the day, in politics, a lot comes down to what's in the mind of the guy or the woman running, and we can't know that. I mean, Mike Huckabee has some grand plan. Perhaps he thinks he can make a claim on the vice presidency. Perhaps he wants to emerge from this battle as sort of the primary spokesman for the the sort of social conservative flank of the party. Perhaps he's gaming for something else. I don't know what's motivating Mike Huckabee. And Ron Paul has never seemed to be about winning. I mean, even when he was raising a lot of money and his supporters, and I know they'll call in and they were all saying we didn't pay enough attention to him. I've heard it a million times. I got to tell you, it was impossible to find the guy. He's never held events. He's never had any press operation. I mean, he's never courted any kind of coverage. He hasn't run like a guy who actually wanted to win the nomination. So whatever's motivating him, and it may be just to get his message across, it certainly hasn't been affected by losing. So they're both hanging around for their own personal reasons, but they are not going to derail John McCain at this point. I think that's pretty obvious.
What about people like James Dobson, who warned the Republican Party well in advance and said, if you don't put up somebody we like, we're staying away? We meaning the so-called religious right, and I really hate that term.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of it myself.
I don't think it's very descriptive, but it's the only one I have at the moment. Someone could come up with a better one. Let's call them the social conservatives. If James Dobson is said to speak for them, which we don't know if that's really true or not, there were other rumblings, particularly I think when it was thought that Giuliani was out in front. Of course, then he got Pat Robertson's endorsement, and who knows what the heck that was all about.
Right.
But assuming that John McCain does become the Republican nominee, will the social conservatives who don't like him sit this one out? Rush seems to be suggesting that that's exactly what people do.
I think some of them might well, because you have to remember the modern Republican Party is really born of a movement, and as opposed to Democrats who governed for most of the 20th century and were very much a governing party. So social conservatives, Republican ground forces are more than willing to sit out an election. They understand the value that can be had in losses, and they're willing to be out of power for a little bit. So it would not shock me if a lot of them did sit home. But I have a slightly different view of this than a lot of commentators. I mean, I think John McCain has some difficult decisions to make, and when he bends to the social conservatives in his party, when he tries so hard to unite the party, and frankly, he hasn't tried that hard, and this is probably why, he loses some of that independent appeal that I think is critical to him winning the presidency. And I think you could make a case. There's a couple reasons why John McCain should not go very far in bending to the conservatives in his party. One is just as I've said, that he needs the independent support that in order to win mathematically, he's going to need people who would not appreciate it, but also because he is, I think, temperamentally much more of an independent, moderate kind of Republican, and this is his moment. He's waited a long time. He's run a very difficult gauntlet. He's somehow been able to secure the nomination of a party where a lot of the base doesn't agree with him. And if he wants to recast Republican politics in a different mold, if he wants to fight for his view of what Republican politics should be, this is the moment. So while I'm sure he wants to try and unify the party, and while between now and the convention you'll see a lot of symbolic gestures, I don't expect John McCain to really expend a whole lot of energy trying to woo the Rush Limbaughs of the world, because I think there's more to gain, in a sense, for him and there's more comfort for him in creating his own kind of Republican campaign than there is in trying to fit into someone else's.
Well, what about James Dobson? Is he still influential within the Republican Party? What about some of these religious leaders who've been active in Republican politics? Does this mean that they're not relevant anymore, or that they're just going to bide their time and wait for the right moment to get back in?
No, I think they're relevant in the sense that they can they do command some loyalties, and they can make it very difficult for McCain and inside the Republican Party. I mean, Rush Limbaugh really is in a league by himself because of the massive scale of his listenership and influence. You know, there are a lot of people who will listen to him. So these are not people without influence. But, you know, politics is changing and life is changing, and institutions and individuals don't command the kind of loyalty they did 20 years ago. I think people are much more free agents. They get a lot of their information on the internet. They get a lot of their information in other sources. There's tons of TV channels, as you know, too many. And so I think the influence is less. We're not in a boss era anymore. I don't think there's any religious leader in the country who commands, you know, an army of voters to do as he pleases any more than there's a union leader in the country who commands, you know, Democrats in labor unions to go and vote for the candidate he wants. And we've seen that repeated again and again. But, you know, they have some influence. And if you're not going to win them over, it's going to cost you something.
We're going to take some phone calls here in just a moment. I want to give you the numbers again because we still have one line open and you could get in. We'll be taking calls, as I said, in just a moment. 800-486-8655. That's a toll-free number, good just about anywhere you can hear this. In Milwaukee, please use our local number, 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. We're talking about Matt Bai, who's a political columnist for the New York Times Magazine, and his column Primary Argument appears on the New York Times website, if you want to go there and look at it. Again, 800-486-8655 and 227-2050 are the numbers. We'll be back in just a moment to continue our discussion. I'm John Munson. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 20 after 9. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week. Kathleen should be back behind the microphone next Tuesday. So we'll have that to look forward to. Be good to have Kathleen back. Later on today on the Ideas Network, do you avoid doing things you know you should but don't want to? Oof, I better not listen to that. After 5 on At Issue, join Gene Purcell and his guest for a conversation about procrastination. Gene is in for Ben Marins today here on the Ideas Network. Well, maybe I'll put off listening to that program until later. And actually, I could now because I could go to our website, WPR.org, and listen to that show anytime I wanted. Okay, enough of that. Here's what we're talking about this hour. It's politics, amazingly enough. Can't get enough of this stuff, can we? Like, everybody wants to watch the train wreck. 800-486-8655, that's a toll-free number. In Milwaukee, it's 227-2050. My guest is Matt Bai, who's a columnist for the New York Times Magazine, and his blog, The Primary Argument, appears on their website. All right, I said we'd go to the phones. I'm going to keep my promise. I'm not running for anything. I can afford to. Let's take Mary Ann in Hurdle first. Mary Ann, good morning.
Good morning. I was paying a whole lot of attention to the results. I'm driving. I'm going to pull off here.
Good idea.
And I live in an area that's predominantly 50-50, Democrat, Republican. I looked at the numbers. Hillary got about 1,400 votes. I'm talking about one specific little township or county. And Obama got about 1,200. So I'm all excited about this. Then I look at the Republican side. McCain only got about 800 votes. I think, and a whole lot of us think, that what happened in Wisconsin was that Republicans crossed over and, in fact, voted for Obama because they're scared to death to go up against Hillary. That's my thought. I also come from Illinois, moved up to Wisconsin about a year and a half ago, so I'm very familiar with Obama. I voted for him when I lived down there, and I'm really sorry I did that. His first act was to vote for Condoleezza Rice, and the second thing that he did that I wasn't too crazy about was to walk outside the door when it came time for the MoveOn.org vote. So the man is a wonderful rhetorical individual. That I have to give him, smooth as silk. However, in terms of health care, in terms of children and what their needs are, we need to put Hillary in there, and I hope to God the superdelegates get it.
Okay, Marianne, thanks for that call.
Marianne's got that's a lot. I understand what Marianne is saying about Republicans crossing over. I don't know if there's any evidence for that. I've never found voters to be all that Machiavellian. You rarely meet the voter. You hear theories like this, but you rarely, if ever, meet the voter who says, "I changed my registration and voted for someone I didn't like because I'm strategically, I don't want someone else to win." It just doesn't happen very often. And if you talk to Republican strategists, they will tell you almost uniformly that Obama scares them a little bit more than Hillary Clinton does as a general election candidate, because they feel like it's easier to define her, and they have a lot of negatives to work with already. Whether or not that would be the case, no one knows, because they're often wrong too. In terms of the superdelegates, that's a whole other subject we could talk about. But I think it is going to come down to that. I plan to talk.
I mean,
Marianne
is
exactly
that.
Right. It is going to come down. If Hillary Clinton stays in the race through to the end of the primaries, which I think she'll do if she wins Texas and Ohio and Pennsylvania, then it is going to come down to the superdelegates. It is going to come down to these folks, and I don't know how willing they are to do what Marianne is suggesting, which is to change the outcome of an election that would be different based on simply the pledged delegates that the voters have chosen. That would thrill a certain segment of people, but it would be tremendously divisive inside the party, and I don't get the sense that they're really willing to do it.
Well, it's been a long time since the nominees for either party were decided in the so-called smoke-filled room. What's happened in both parties to a certain extent is kind of interesting when you look at the last 30 or 40 years of electoral politics, and particularly for the Democrats. 1972 was kind of a turning point where an outsider candidate, George McGovern, was able to capture the system, use the primary system to get himself the nomination, and then was crushed in the general election. And that seemed to start kind of a pattern in some regard. Jimmy Carter was kind of an outsider candidate against the Kennedys. I know there's been some discussion, because there's discussion about pretty much anything you could think of, and probably some things you shouldn't, on the internet about how the Democratic Party, the system is built now, and how it works or doesn't work, depending on your point of view. But there are a number of different interpretations as to how many delegates Obama needs to put himself over the top. There's the question of Michigan and Florida. Will those delegations be seated or won't they? And, of course, Hillary Clinton won in both those states, even though, was Obama's name even on the Michigan ballot? I don't think it was.
No, it was not.
But the point is that there's been a process that's kind of been at work over the last 30 years or so, and what you're saying is, if in the Democrats' case, if they decide to upset the apple cart and go back to making it an insider game, they could really be doing themselves some damage.
Well, the superdelegates come from exactly, you describe it very well, exactly that impulse. It's a rather rich story about irony. The reformers, the good government types who took over Democratic politics after 1968, created this open primary system, and then three elections later they found they kept losing because outsider candidates either won the nomination and lost in the general, or in the case of 1980, launched a very divisive primary that helped them lose the general. And then the people in power decided that now having opened up the system, now that they were the ones in power, they really wanted a little more control over the process. And so they created this superdelegate system, which is basically national committee people, elected officials, and there's a bunch of at-large, about 75 at-large delegates who are just powerful Democrats in Washington and constituent groups. And these folks all have a big say, a big vote. They've not been needed since 1984 because we rarely have a primary fight that close, especially with the front-loaded calendar we have now. But they are going to be factor in this year because what you have is effectively a draw. So for Hillary Clinton, if she doesn't win these big states coming up by very large margins, and I think that's unlikely because that's not the way this primary has gone and her campaign has been struggling, then she really has two options available to her if she's to win the nomination. And one would be to get, and maybe some combination of them, one would be to get those Florida and Michigan delegates back in, and that's going to be extremely difficult, but it's possible there could be a deal worked out to get at least some of those delegates back in or to apportion them by some formula that would be mutually agreeable. She did win in both of those states, despite the fact that there was no real campaign. And then the second thing, and the bigger thing, would be these superdelegates. And there's a fight going on between Senators Clinton and Obama about what the superdelegates are really there to do, because Senator Clinton says they're there to pick the candidate they like best, who they think is the best president and nominee. And Senator Obama says they're there to ratify the will of the voters. He's just wrong about that, because if they were there to ratify the will of the voters, they never would have been created. They're actually will of the voters.
Yeah, I mean, what would be their purpose? I mean,
it's actually the exact opposite. They were actually created as a bulwark against the voters, right? They were actually created to overrule the voters if necessary. So they're certainly not there. Their responsibility is not to ratify the voters. But he's got a point in the sense that if they don't do that, if they don't ratify the will of voters, then it could be extremely divisive and damaging to the party. And in that sense, I think he has a strong point to make.
Let's take a call from Victor in Oconomowoc. Victor, good morning.
Matt, John, good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
Okay.
Good. Thanks, Victor.
I have several comments. First of all, like my friend at work says, you can stick a fork in Hillary. She's done. The reason I agree with that statement is because even if she gets the nomination, all of the enthusiastic Obama supporters will be disillusioned. Stay home. You have McCain as president. And that's, I don't see her filling stadiums of people with enthusiastic supporters like Obama. As far as McCain and the Republicans is concerned, I want to come back, John, to your point regarding the, let's call them religious fanatics. That's what they are. Religious right, I don't think so. These people, including Rush Limbaugh, are scared to death of McCain because if he becomes president, what you have is someone whom they have opposed who has won. Their power is diminished. It may ultimately be to the benefit of true Republicans, true conservatives, for these religious fanatics to lose their influence. McCain's victory would be a loss for them. Finally, with regards to Marianne's point about Obama, you've got to remember that at the heart of every politician is an arrogant sycophant. I like you, I want your vote, but I'm smart enough to rule over you. And people need to be less naive about what politicians are. I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Victor, thanks a lot. A lot to chew on there.
Yeah, I mean, those are some good comments. I'm not convinced. I think it really depends on how either Senator Clinton or Senator Obama win. That determines whether people are going to stay home in November. I have a less Armageddonish feel about this than other people do who are watching this. I tend to think that if it's decided fairly, if people think the process was fair, if it doesn't come down to superdelegates being pressured or the convention floor or anything else, then I think most of these supporters are going to lick their wounds. They're going to be upset for a month or so, and then they're going to go out and vote for the nominee because there's not a whole lot of ideological daylight between these two candidates. There's nothing to start the kind of moderate versus liberal war or conservative versus centrist that really tears parties apart. It's all about really personality and style. And as long as people feel it's fair, I think they're going to be able to make that adjustment. If they don't think it's fair, if they feel a nomination was stolen, and certainly it's getting harder for Senator Clinton to win the nomination without that feeling lingering with people because of the way she would need to do it, as I just described, then that, I think that would be actually a very difficult scenario for the party. As far as Senator McCain goes, I think that's, I think Victor's got an excellent point. I mean, I think that every constituency group worries about losing power. This is why constituency groups make threats and oppose candidates. It's partly because of the issues they care about, but it's largely because if the wrong guy gets elected, they don't get their hard pass to the White House. They don't get to, throw their influence around and say they control someone. And I do think there's a tremendous amount of trepidation among social conservatives and the rightward flank of the party, not just about how John McCain would govern, but about whether he would be someone they could get access to and get a sympathetic ear from on the issues they care about when they need to.
Of course, he would still have to be able to deal with Republicans in Congress, many of whom owe their seats to those same social conservatives who don't care much for McCain. Let's assume for a moment that he was elected and that the Democrats retained their majorities in both houses of Congress. Let's say he decides to veto something. Would he be able to count on all of the Republican senators or representatives to support him in a veto fight?
Well, we don't know.
That's real speculation.
But that comes down to things. That comes down to less than to things that are more important than ideology. That comes down to how popular is he in the public, how strong is he going to be in midterm elections, how much do they need him to help the party win at the local level. I mean, those things are determined by a lot more than whether you agree with the person or not. There were a lot of Democrats who did not like Bill Clinton's brand of politics, who voted with him in many key points during his presidency because he was critical to their success. The other interesting thing about McCain is that he has a lot of friends on the Democratic side in the Senate, and has worked in a bipartisan way on a lot of issues over the last several years. So whether he could retain that as president, whether he could actually build what Obama calls effectively a governing majority, whether he could actually build a sort of old-style majority that wasn't just Democrat against Republican is a real question. It's a question for him. It's a question for Obama, should he become the nominee, because they both hold out that promise. And it is worth remembering that there was a time in American politics, civil rights legislation was not passed by Democrats over the objections of Republicans. It was passed by a coalition of Democrats and Republicans who were like-minded in that regard. And I think it's important, it is important to remember that politics doesn't have to be about one party overruling the other all the time. But that's certainly the moment.
It doesn't.
Well, theoretically not, but that is certainly the moment we've lived in for a while.
Well, I'm glad I was sitting down when I heard that. Let's go next to Sally in Middleton. Sally, good morning. Thanks for joining us. Hello, Sally. Are you there? Sally,
good morning.
You're on. Good morning.
Thanks very much for taking my call. I don't get to hear the debates because I don't have cable. And I really, in a democracy, I think that's not a good way to go, to make people who can't afford cable, don't want to go into debt, they're just shut out. And in a democracy, that shouldn't be.
So the debates should be on over-the-air television and everybody could get them.
Yeah, or radio even. I've tried the radio stations. I couldn't find it anyplace. So I was just disenfranchised, or maybe not that, but aren't the airwaves supposed to belong to the people?
Well, that's the rumor I keep hearing, but I don't know that there's enough evidence for a conviction.
They do here on Wisconsin Public Radio, do they not?
Well, there you go. Thanks for that, Matt.
That's a good point, Sal. I haven't thought about that, but you raise a good point. I would think that most of them are available on radio. I know CNN has radio, but I'm not sure how widely available in markets that is. So, You know, I guess you could make a case that we're living in a new day and just about everything's on, you know, cable or satellite, but people are adapting to it or on the internet. So, you know, just having broadcast TV as your only medium is going to necessarily probably prevent you from a lot of options, both in information and entertainment, and even more as the years pass. But you raise a good point. I mean, I am a believer that public airways should be cooperative in bringing politics and political campaigns of this kind of level to American voters in a very in a free and general way. And it does irritate me, particularly in the early part of the primary season when, for instance, ABC had a debate and its affiliates refused to carry it. It does irritate me that the broadcast networks don't take that responsibility more seriously than they seem to.
Well, not to put too fine a point on it, but I don't think any of these TV events on cable have actually been debates.
Well, yeah,
I've been in debates, and trust me, these are not debates. You basically have candidates with pre-prepared positions on everything. And yes, I know if you're going to debate, you have to prepare, and you have to have points you're going to make, and you have to have evidence to back yourself up. But a debate is two people engaging one another on the issues back and forth without a moderator in between them. Get up there and actually have a debate. Go at it on the issues. Throw out the clock on questions, and you know, don't take questions from the audience and all that. That's not a debate. Decide what the question is. Okay, we're going to have a debate about health care. All right, so Senator Clinton, Senator Obama, front and center, and talk about health care and what you're going to do and why your plan is better. Same thing about, okay, what about national security? Well, what's your plan? What about Iraq? And have the candidates talk to each other. Those would be debates. I don't think that what we're seeing on cable TV, and frankly, I have to say personally, I haven't watched one of them yet, but they aren't debates. They're media events of some kind. We call them debates, but they really aren't.
Well, I wouldn't go as far as you on that, John. I agree that some of these debates are less than stellar, particularly when you have a lot of the candidates involved in the earlier stages. But, if you watch them, I mean, there are some very good and illuminating moments. I mean, at this point, we've sort of heard them all, and they're repeated endlessly. But they've had some pretty substantive arguments. They've had substantive arguments about health care. Health care mandates an issue I happen to think is very overblown and should not really be the source of a lot of attention. But it is an issue they fought about considerably. They've had some substantive exchanges with each other, and the problem is they just agree on a whole lot, and a lot of that is because Democrats in general have defined themselves against President Bush and against the Republicans, and they have really very little ideological difference between them, and it's hard to have continual debates when you don't have a whole lot to debate. And so in that sense, Sally, I don't think, if you're reading the paper, I don't think you're missing a whole lot.
Well, the most reported aspect of last night's debate was Senator Clinton's Xerox comment. There were probably better moments in the debate, but that one is kind of a button moment. You can make a short video clip out of it.
Yeah, we're a predictable bunch, aren't we, journalists? You can't align, come up with a canned line, bring it at the right moment, and
bingo.
Lo and behold, we'll put it in the lead of our story.
You put the right bait in the water, the fish is going to rise to it every time.
Yeah.
We're going to take some more calls at 800-486-8655 and 227-2050. In just a moment, my guest is Matt Bai, who writes a political blog for the online version of the New York Times Magazine called The Primary Argument. He's also a columnist for the New York Times Magazine and the author of the book, The Argument, Billionaires, Bloggers, and the Battle to Remake Democratic Politics. He's my guest this hour, and you can talk to him and ask questions and join our discussion in just a moment. I'm John Munson. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:42. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, next hour, going to talk about fair pricing with the author of a book titled, The Price is Wrong, Understanding What Makes a Price Seem Fair and the True Cost of Unfair Pricing. So if you ever feel like you've been gouged on something, tune in next hour. We'll find out why you feel that way and perhaps even what you can do about it. That's coming up next hour here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Politics This Hour with Matt Bai, who writes a political blog for the New York Times, and it's on their website, and is also a columnist for the New York Times Magazine. And his blog is titled The Primary Argument. He's also the author of the book, The Argument, Billionaires, Bloggers, and the Battle to Remake Democratic Politics, published by Penguin Press. 800-486-8655 is our toll-free number. In Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. Let's go back to the phones and take a call from Beth in Appleton. Beth, good morning.
Good morning. Matt, I wanted to let you know that I think you were right about what the Republicans were doing. I just ran across a website in Wisconsin that was a red state with badger kind of website, and they were encouraging their members to vote for Hillary Clinton. And they had an online poll that said 41% of them were going to do it. I have no idea whether they did or how many people, and you don't have to register in Wisconsin, so who knows. But what I wanted to say was really about the eloquence of the candidates being a significant point in my decision. Now, after working for Edwards and coming away from Iowa and licking my wounds, I decided to support Obama, and it's because their policies and plans aren't that different. But the ability to persuade the American people to be behind the plans is, I think, what's going to make the difference in getting them implemented. And I heard John Edwards speak three times when he was in, or Barack Obama speak three times when he was in Wisconsin, and Hillary Clinton once. And I just think that that is a key. It's not, I mean, it's look. People say that being persuasive is empty or even somehow suspicious, but I think it's an important qualification.
You know, I mean, Beth, I think that's a very fair interpretation of the modern presidency and a very important point in the campaign. I really do, because, you know, this has been a really a linchpin of the debate, is Senator Clinton saying, look, I know where all the levers and the pulleys are in government. I've been around it. I understand how you get things done. I understand what you need to do, and I'm ready coming into office to sort of work these deals and work these you know, the back hallways and get it done. And you know, it's sort of a Lyndon Johnson argument about how the presidency works. And Obama is saying, you know, is a little more in the Reagan-Clinton mold, is kind of saying, look, that's not how change happens. Change happens in the modern media environment and politics because you persuade people, because you inspire them. I mean, he's not afraid. He actually said last night, I thought last night in the debate, I don't know if you saw it, but last night in the debate, I thought he offered the most succinct and pointed sort of summary of what he's arguing here when he said, you know, change happens when you nothing's going to happen unless you inspire people to go out and change their country, and unless you inspire people to overcome the divisions of the parties. And you know, that does get mocked as, you know, inspiration doesn't get you anything and it's empty rhetoric. And I think that's a fair point, too. I think this is a good debate to have. But I think it's perfectly legitimate to believe, when you look at how the modern presidency has operated and the people who've been successful in this environment, that that a certain amount of persuasion, and not just persuasion of your peers, but persuasion of the American people, is required in order to break sort of log jams of legislation. I think that's a legitimate view to have, and I think it's a good debate to have.
Beth, thanks for that call. Let's go next to Donna in Round Lake.
Morning, John. Hi, Matt. Hey, you know, I also voted for Obama in Illinois, and I have been so disappointed because from day one, he's been campaigning for president. And I think in doing that, he's missed out on a lot of his opportunities to learn how to manipulate the system or change it from within. A lot of times you got to make the change from within. But there are so many issues that he hasn't, so many things happening here that he hasn't voted on, or he votes present, which is making no commitment. And if he can't do his job for Illinois, I don't know how he could do it for the company, for the country. But more than that, I could never see myself voting for somebody for president that doesn't want to put his hand over his heart for the national anthem or the Pledge of Allegiance and doesn't want to say the pledge. I think it was on Oprah where he was saying that doesn't mean that's not a symbol of your patriotism or anything. Those are some of the few things that we still have to remind us of what we were founded for. And Matt, I know you called us naive, or you didn't think we'd be naive about a couple of issues. People do pull opposing party ballots to try to influence who it is their candidate will be voting for. And I hate to say it, but I've done it myself. I did it when the first Bush was elected. So those were just some points. You guys pushed a lot of buttons for me today. and people do pull other ballots. And so thanks for listening.
Thanks for the call, Donna.
Well, thanks, Don. Let's just clarify a couple of things. I mean, first, I absolutely did not call voters naive. I don't believe it, and I've never said it. I think what I said was that I don't think that any sizable number of voters make Machiavellian choices about how to cast their vote to hurt someone else. I think generally voters vote for, if they can find a candidate they care about, that's who they vote for, because they want to express their own political views, and I think that's right, and I think that's what they tend to do. So I don't think voters are naive. I think they actually care about politics and the process more than to make sort of these kinds of calculations and use their vote for that purpose. Now you may have done that. I know Donna says she did, and I find that interesting. But I just don't meet a lot of voters who actually do. I'm sure there are some. But I think it's very important. There's a few things I could address there, but I think it's very important to clarify this issue on the Pledge of Allegiance, because we don't responsibility, at least of journalists, is to make sure we don't leave false impressions with people. It is not true that Senator Obama doesn't say the Pledge of Allegiance. That's just patently false. In fact, as he's pointed out many times, he's led the Pledge of Allegiance on the floor of the United States Senate. He says the Pledge of Allegiance every time it's appropriate, and I think that would absolutely be a misperception. What is true is that there's video of Senator Obama not putting his hand over his heart when he says the Pledge of Allegiance, and this does irritate some people, and I think it plays into a larger theme with him, because you also have this situation last week with his wife, Michelle Obama, saying this is the first time she's been proud of her country in her lifetime. The campaign says she meant her country's politics, but there is certainly a strain here of cynicism about him, people who feel that he's not patriotic enough. I will say this, I suppose in his defense, you can interpret it any way you like, but I had this conversation with a Democratic operative here in Washington a couple weeks ago, a senior operative. We were talking about this very issue, and he was saying, this video, people not putting, you don't put your hand over your heart in the Pledge of Allegiance, and it's going to, that's going to come back and haunt you. And I kind of laughed. I said, do you know anybody under 40 who puts their hand over their heart when they say the Pledge of Allegiance? I mean, go to a ball game. I said to this guy, have you ever gone to a ball game? Go to a ball game and take a look around during the national anthem.
Well, it's hard enough to get people to take off their hats.
I mean, you'll find everybody over, say, 50, right, with a hat off or their hand over their heart, and everybody under 40, standing, erect and either singing along but not going through those motions. This is a generational thing. Things have changed in America. There's a generation that simply wasn't taught to do that if they haven't served in the military or what have you. So I think there's a divide there. I think generationally we're at a moment of transition, and different Americans look at that issue differently.
Maybe he doesn't need the over 40 vote then.
Well, no, I'm not suggesting, Don, it's not a problem, because obviously a lot of people will react as you do. I'm just saying I think voters of generation look at this a slightly different way, and I think that says something interesting about the moment we're in American politics. How much it hurts them or helps them, I can't say.
Let's go next to Paul in Minocqua. Paul, you're up.
Hi. I would just like to comment on the caller that talked about being a Republican that actually voted for Barack Obama. I voted Republican in every primary and general election for president. I'm 40 years old, and this time I did vote for Obama, not to skew the results, but just because I think the country needs to head in a different direction.
Okay, Paul, thanks for that.
That's fascinating. Thank you, Paul, for at least confirming my basic point of view that some people do vote for their consciences and not to mess with the results. But I think there's a fair amount of that going on, particularly among independents. I mean, and I don't know. Some of this has to do with Obama and the appeal that he's making, the sort of post-partisan appeal and the generational change. Paul mentioned that he's 40, and I think for a lot of people, I'm almost 40 myself, and for a lot of people of our generation, I think there is an overwhelming sense that it is past time for the baby boomer generation of leadership to be moved aside. And I think a lot of people are simply excited, not by ideology or by personality, but by the notion that we could have a generational change, and that could mean a change in the way we debate issues in America. But I also think this has a lot to do with how Republicans feel about their own party more than anything. I think if it weren't Obama, maybe it would be someone else. But I do think that the last 8 years have, and really even before that, have soured a lot of traditional Republicans on the direction of their party, and they, you know, they're cynical about the party's ability to restore some of the values they care about in American government. And so I do think you have a lot of dissatisfied Republicans out there who are looking for a different way.
Paul, are you still with us?
Yes, I am. I also think just that if the Clinton, I'm not a Clinton hater like some people are, but I just see more of the same with Hillary Clinton. I think I would actually vote for McCain over Hillary in a general election.
What was it that made you decide to support Obama over McCain?
I see more of the same with McCain. I just look at our standing in the world, and I think it's diminished quite a bit over the years. McCain is a war hero, no question about it, and I respect him greatly. I just think that even as the world sees us and as we see ourselves, I think Mr. Obama represents the most, the freshest, the more of the change, the more of the way the country wants to go, if that makes any sense.
Okay. Paul, thanks a lot for that call. Let's go next to Gail and Ephraim. Gail, good morning.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My main concerns are with Barack Obama and also McCain. There's a few things. With the fact that Oprah began to champion Obama, I'm really concerned that these Oprah zombies are going to be out there voting for him, for these extremely idealistic fairy tale ideas in their head, because this guy is just not qualified to handle the major issues we have going on now. And there's so many things unanswered about him that I am really concerned that if that man gets in, it's going to be a real problem here, and especially with the fact that he's going to be 40, and there's issues when people become 40, they come up against themselves in if they really are who they say they are. And with the rhetoric coming out about him and, you know, however you want to say the arguments are coming out against him or for him, the reality of it is that he just doesn't know if he's going to be able to actually walk the talk. And the idea of the body language is if he doesn't put his hand over his heart, he's just talking. He ain't walking. And I'm concerned about McCain being in, because he, in the past, has championed for bills for lobbyists in order to take away the powers of municipalities and the public, and has put them in harm's way. One major one was with the cell tower issues, and municipalities were crippled with a bill that he helped pass for the cell phone industry in order to eliminate their blocking of cell towers. They had to put one up. And the controversy over the health issues and health concerns over that radiations and, all of that, that really puts me into a concern about him, too. What's he going to champion for the industry and not take care of the public, which is supposed to vote for him?
So, Gail, if it ends up being Obama versus McCain, who are you going to vote for?
Two issues out on the table, because maybe a lot of people don't remember or don't know
okay.
if that was happening.
Hang on.
Thanks a lot.
Hang on, Gail. Well, hang on, Gail. Don't go away. If it's McCain against Obama, who are you going to vote for? Well, I guess we lost Gail. I think we've got time for a real quick call from Nan in Milwaukee. We're almost out of time, Nan, so I'll ask you to be brief. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to follow up on the comment that Matt had made regarding superdelegates. I thought you made a really good point that hasn't really been out in the public discourse as much about that their purpose is actually not to follow the will of the voters. But I just wanted to sort of amplify that. My understanding from the system was that they would go against the will of the voters if the candidate, likely candidate, were some outlier who wouldn't fare well or likely fare well in the general election. Whereas
okay.
That's not the case.
Let's let Matt have a chance to quickly respond to that, because we're almost out of
time.
Sure.
Let me just quickly say about Gail, because, again, just for accuracy's sake, Obama's not going to be 40. He's 46, so we can hope he's past his midlife crises or what have you, but he's definitely older than that. Yeah, this is a good point about the superdelegates. There is no rule about that. I mean, that certainly was the thought process, but that's certainly not part of the job description. I mean, basically, the superdelegates The job of the superdelegates is to represent sort of the institutional party knowledge and machinery. The idea is if you've worked hard for the party or been elected by the party, you should have a bigger say. It's not quite the party bosses of the 40s and 50s who got to decide the nomination, but it gives that party machinery a disproportionate say in terms in relation to the voters over who the nominee should be. And it's not about really whether, I mean, certainly they would interpret it as about being an outlier versus a mainstream candidate, but it's really just about who the institution of the party prefers. What I think is interesting this year is that I think the institutions in general in America are changing, and political parties are changing. And what you're finding among the superdelegates is while they are still insiders in the traditional sense, they don't really have any unanimity because that's just not how things work anymore. It's not as if you're part of the institution, therefore you back the institutional candidate. People
right.
are making individual choices. We are a nation of free agents. And it's very, very hard for any candidate, Hillary Clinton included.
And we'll have to leave it there.
Okay.
I'm afraid we're out of time.
Sorry,
Matt Bai, thank you so much for this hour.
Anytime. Thank you. I'm glad to do it.
I'm John Munson, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.